Good morning, everyone. I'd like to open the January 27, 2009 session of the House Subcommittee on Workforce Development. Good morning. I'd like to thank everyone for coming out. Today, we're going to have another informational meeting on workforce development. And they're going to hear first from the Governor's Office and James Sager, the Senior Policy Advisor for the Governor. Would you like to come up as a panel? Okay, please come up. Recognize Mr. Paulson and Mr. White. Are you coming up too? Okay. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Welcome to our committee.
Chair Litt, members of the committee, for the record, I'm James Sager with the Governor's Office, and if you don't mind, Chairman, I'll let Mr. Paulson start off the presentation, and then I'll pick it up after he's finished.
Please.
Chair Litt and committee, good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to introduce myself. I'm James Paulson, and I'm the Director of Workforce Planning and Staffing for the Standard up in Portland, as well as I serve on the local Workforce Investment Board in the Portland metro area. I'm the chair of that board, as well as I'm the vice chair of the statewide Oregon Workforce Investment Board, the OWIB. And today I'm here to talk to you as in my capacity as the vice chair of the OWIB. Let me start by kind of explaining what the OWIB is. The OWIB is an advisory board to the governor on workforce matters. The OWIB is made up of leaders representing the private sector, labor, state, and local governments, and government agencies. As we all know, Oregon is in a very competitive race for talent across the world. And we work together to really try and grow and build jobs and really try and build the workforce here in Oregon so that we are going to be competitive as a place for businesses to locate and grow within our area. And so we really look at what we can do statewide in collaboration with the different local workforce investment boards across the state on how we can leverage the resources that we have available to us to build that workforce, understanding that, you know, the workforce that we work with across the state is very it's varied, so the challenges are different, and so it really means a lot of collaboration amongst a lot of different folks, and we really act as kind of a coordinator of that collaboration. We have as kind of our mission is to, for the whole state of Oregon, for the Oregon employers to have a competitive advantage in the global marketplace due to highly skilled and innovative workers, and that's really what we use as kind of the tenor that drives the work that we do. It is generally accepted that the state's economy rests on the skills of its workforce. In the global economy, we can't compete on price. We have to compete on our ability to innovate, use higher level thinking and problem-solving skills. For this reason, the OWIB has advised the governor that the development of skills for the workforce has the highest priority. That is true for all segments of the workforce, the emerging workforce, the current workforce, and the transitional workforce. As I go through the rest of my presentation, you will recognize that all of the OWIB's actions and priorities have the ultimate outcome of increasing the skills of Oregon's workers in order to assist business to attract, maintain high skill, high wage jobs for Oregon employment. One thing that I want to really kind of point out is what really brought the OWIB into existence, because I'm not sure if you guys are familiar. Back in 1998, the Federal Workforce Investment Act, WIA, required state workforce investment boards for each state nationwide. Oregon had a long history of workforce boards through those required by the State Training Partnership Act and later the Workforce Quality Council, but the act required a newly constituted board, which we named the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. As Oregon often does, we use the federal legislation to accomplish our own purposes. We made sure that the board recognized the needs and carried out the direction of the state as a whole. that the duties of the board meshed with Oregon's vision for a workforce system much larger than the one that the federal act had set. The wider definition of the workforce system continues to this day. OWIB's strategic plan, which was named Winning in the Global Market, was accepted by the governor as his strategic plan for workforce development in June of 2006. It's a five-year plan to transform Oregon's workforce education and training system with three main goals. First goal is to identify and meet the needs of Oregon's businesses for skilled workers, provide students and workers with the skills employers demand, continue to build an efficient and effective workforce education system. The accomplishment of these goals is aimed at the heart of the issue, to enhance the global competitiveness of the state. The board currently has 24 members. As required by the WIA, the majority of the members must come from business. And I really want to impress upon you, we're just talking about the OWIB board has 24 members. You also have boards across the state that also have a mandate that they have to definitely link with business and industry in their area. And so you really need to understand that you've got committed companies and committed representatives of those companies that are volunteering their time to really move this conversation forward. And so I really want to drive that forward, that there's really a lot of people across the state, not just at the OWIB, but that are engaged in this work. It's also made up of organized labor, educational entities, local government, and elected officials. To reduce the overall membership of the board from an unwieldy 40, a more manageable sized board was mandated by our governor that required, we moved away from having 40 people all sitting there, and we said, you know what, let's really have some key players there from the workforce policy cabinet so that they were representing representatives of the governor, and so that they could really be engaged in the work that we were doing instead of just kind of showing up and being there for attendance purposes, because we're really trying to focus on really moving the work forward, and having a board that was a little more nimble we felt was beneficial in doing that. So now let me talk about some of the accomplishments that we've had over the recent history. The OWIB developed the Employer Workforce Training Fund, which is an innovative use of the WIA funds for local incumbent worker training and the workforce system capacity building statewide. When all of the numbers are in for the latest year, 2007-2008, we expect that during the period, 9,169 incumbent workers will have been trained in 136 projects with individual businesses in all 15 regions in the state. Another program that we moved forward, the OWIB has focused on achieving the strategic plan, Winning in the Global Market. The OWIB reorganized its committee structure with this in mind. The chairs of the working committees are now the business members of the executive committee. What we did is we created committees specifically focused on the different aspects of the strategic plan that we put together. Examples would be communication. Another example would be business and industry. Each one of those committees was chaired by someone who sat on the board from industry, and then that way that individual industry person then drove that conversation, and so that we had more engagement from the folks in industry that sat on the board, because we really want to move that conversation forward. And so that's why we aligned the organization that way. And then having the executive committee, which meets once a month, the big board meets on a quarterly basis. The executive committee meets on a monthly basis so that we can get updates, what's going on with the different committees, making sure that we have committee alignment with the strategic plan. And as we all know, change happens. And so sometimes we need to make adjustments that way. And again, it really makes us much more nimble on moving the different projects and programs forward. Um, to work the work plan of the OWIB has focused on supporting the creation and maintaining of high-skilled, high-wage, high-demand jobs in every part of the state. In partnership with the employment the Oregon Employment Department, the OWIB defined just what jobs those are in every part of the state, along with a top 20 list to help guide the investments in training funds. And really what we've done here is really looked at how can we really go out there and identify what sort of jobs we want to do the development in. And like I said before, throughout the state, the needs are different. And really having a clear understanding of those needs being different, and then partnering with the Oregon Employment Department, considering that they've got a very strong system statewide, and we are there to support that. The OWIB developed a manufacturing strategy to raise awareness of the importance of skilled manufacturing jobs in Oregon and to increase high-performance manufacturing practices statewide. This coming year, the strategy will concentrate on connecting the dots of all the work to support manufacturing around the state, such as a new community college manufacturing certificate, expanded technical education and career pathways in manufacturing, the healthcare industry, even in this economy, is creating high-skilled, high-wage jobs in every part of the state. Oregon needs to prepare its citizens for these jobs, both in nursing and in allied occupations. To help coordinate this effort, the OWIB worked with industry and public stakeholders to develop the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Initiative, which has become the healthcare workforce coordinator and advisory body for this industry, education, and the OWIB, and the governor. Previous to working at the Standard, I worked for Kaiser Permanente, and I was actively involved in really bringing this to life. One of the reasons we really needed to bring this together is there were a multitude of different initiatives and programs going on having to deal with healthcare. And so what the Institute was saying is someone needs to go out there and have a clear understanding of what we're doing across the state. Let's get some coordination, because there was too much duplication of spend, too much duplication of what we were doing. So what we wanted to do is have a single entity that had that information, so if someone wanted to move a program or an idea forward, start there and see who else was working on it so you could piggyback on that. We really want to use the funds available to us effectively. And so that's one of the things that the Institute is helping us do. The OWIB developed an influential future workforce needs study, which identifies the opportunities Oregon has to grow traded sector industries and employment. Following the first recommendation in the study, the OWIB partnered with the Oregon Employment Department and the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department to identify green jobs for clean technology development. When the report of this project is finalized in June, we will have a clear picture of what green jobs actually are and in what industries and locations these exist. And I think that everyone is very clear the importance of green jobs, not only from the output as far as green jobs helping us save energy, but really looking at these green jobs as being a new opportunity to really invigorate our economy. And, you know, I've seen it written that the Oregon economy is on the leading edge of green technology. I see a number of you have the wind turbine lapel pins, and so I think that you're absolutely aligned with that.
Which camera?
They aren't propellers either.
They're not propellers.
The wind capital of the state of Oregon, whose district is that?
That would be me.
Excellent.
Can I ask a question?
Please.
Thank you, Chair.
Vice Chair Huffman.
James, the report's going to identify jobs and or opportunities in green jobs or the green arena. Will the report also couple in with that programs like at Columbia Gorge Community College where there are training opportunities for these green jobs? They'll be identified in the report?
Yes. Okay. That's really the goal, because there's one of the things where I really think of the greatest opportunity when we look at green jobs and really looking into, you know, an emerging industry is really understanding that industry and understanding the needs of that industry and understanding what are the channels, what are the transferable skills that can move somebody into the industry. You know, you can get a one-to-one if you have somebody, say, for example, who has a strong construction background, you know, and going over and doing green maintenance might be a one-to-one. You might have somebody who has a different skill set that might require some skills training to get into a specific aspect. And that's where you'll notice throughout this we talk about really building on the educational system around workforce development. And it's key that you have those pieces in place so then you're able to transition those workers into the jobs in which the need for tomorrow is.
James, would you mind if as you proceed, if we have questions or comments, if we interjected during your presentation, or would you prefer that we hold it until after you've finished?
No, I'm open to questions at any time, Chairman.
Thank you very much. Representative Dembrough?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I just have a quick question. So when is the report due to come out, James?
The report is due out in June. And so at June, we'll have a much better idea of what comes out of that report, and then that report will help drive a lot of the different initiatives in which we want to kind of move forward.
Thank you.
Representative Holdy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have just a couple of structural questions. You mentioned that the focus was on high-wage, high-skilled jobs, and I'm curious, I've asked this once before, what is the current definition of high-wage? What's the annual salary of a high-wage job in the state of Oregon?
Yeah.
Do you want
me? Go ahead.
Why did you?
Well, Chair Witt and Representative Holby, what we ask the Employment Department to do is to look at it regionally so that we don't have a single definition. Historically, rightly so, many parts of the state objected to the material put out because it was very metro-centric. And so rather than saying the average wage in the metro area might be, you know, $20 an hour, and that doesn't relate to anything in Coos County, we have now been able to isolate it by county to identify what are the high-wage, high-demand jobs in that region so that we can build on that economy rather than looking at just at a state level.
So, follow up,
please.
Can we get a breakdown of the different regions and what a high-wage definition is in each of those regions?
Sure, we can get that for you.
Thank you, Representative Holby. That would be very useful. Vice Chair Huffman.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Witt. I agree. That would be very beneficial. I think I represent one of the lower income strata in the state, and I was just wondering if we could ask Dr. Tota, could you give us, and this would be directly applicable to the renewable energy industry in what has historically been a low-income region. People coming out of the certificated program at Columbia Gorge on wind technicians, what is the typical wage that they are going to work for out in the field? Is there any way of putting a dollar figure on that?
Yes, or the currently range? The average.
Excuse me, Dr. Tota, would you please identify yourself?
Dr. Frank Tota, President, Columbia Gorge Community College.
Thank you, sir, and welcome.
Also a home of the first congressionally recognized wind tech program on the West Coast. Exciting technology. We find ourselves with lots of folks coming through the program right now because right now it is being recognized as a job training training where there is actually a job at the end of the training. To answer your question, Representative Huffman, the average wage is in the 18 to 30 range depending on the type of job they have. It really depends on the type of job they have. Right now there's such a shortage of wind techs in the region. I'm talking Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. We have some wind technicians that are making six-figure incomes right now today. And the way they're doing that that is it's not a unionized activity, so they're pulling multiple shifts, and some of the younger technicians who are trying to build a nest egg are actually working 2-3 shifts at a time, and that's how they're pulling in the six-figure incomes. That word has got out on the street, and so we've always got a waiting list to get into the training program because our WIN partners have all but guaranteed that if you go to Columbia Gorge Community College, you will come out with a job. And again, not to sound evasive, but it does range 18 to 30 depending on what area of the WIN technician job that they have.
Is this, Representative Holby, is this for WIN technology? I don't want to lose sight of Mr. Paulson's presentation, so.
Well, this is directly related to Mr. Paulson's, I'm sorry.
I understand.
It's related to workforce training. That's why we're here. We're here to support the presentation made by James, and we are very supportive of this activity.
And certainly appreciate that very much, and I think the wage rate that you described is testimony to the success of your program. What I'm going to do is I'm going to suggest that we move forward with Mr. Paulson's presentation.
Sorry.
And Doctor, we would, when he's finished, I would like some follow-up because I know that Representative Holby and I as well also have some questions I'd like to direct to you.
Yes, sir.
Perfect. Mr. Paulson, please.
I think this is a really perfect time to segue. We've got a lot of other successes in youth apprenticeships and youth education as well, but I think this is a good segue to really talk about what we're going to be really focusing on in the near future.
Mm-hmm.
And we're embarking on, every 2 years, the WIA and state policy require the development of strategic and compliance with the rules of the WIA, with each of the local regions have to come with their strategic plan. They will bring that strategic plan, each of their individual strategic plans, to the OWIB board, and which gives us an opportunity to link their strategic plans to the statewide strategic plan, which is an activity that hasn't been as robust in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And we're really looking at really how we can tighten that up and really work in really close concert with all the different regional workforce boards so that we're able to leverage the work that's going on in one area of the state across the state and really get a clear understanding of that. The Oregon workforce system is planning for nearly doubling the WIA resources through the federal stimulus package. We expect increases in employment and training resources for adults and dislocated workers, worker funding, an increase in the employment service funds, and a new summer youth employment program. While this is a good problem to have, the system needs to do considerable work to assure successful delivery. The system partners have been streamlining and expanding customer service in the WorkSource Oregon centers and identifying the skills of unemployed workers to better match them with expected infrastructure development jobs. One of the things that we're really working on and really putting a lot of focus on right now is with the stimulus funds on the horizon, and I know that everyone is putting, you know, their pitch in for these stimulus funds, and we estimate the stimulus funds to be, you know, a lot of numbers have been thrown out there, anywhere from $30 million to, you know, double that. We have no idea exactly what those funds will look like as far as when it reaches our state. At least I don't have any clarity to that now. But really, where we're looking at is from a strategic standpoint, and we've already really started working with the local boards and with the state board and saying, you know what, we have our 5-year strategic plan, but like I talked about, the economy is constantly changing, and we're in very much a big change from where we were, you know, 3-4 years ago when we put that plan together. And right now, we need to have a strategic plan around how can we manage the stimulus funds? How can we prepare ourselves? How can we tee ourselves up? We want to make sure that Oregon is at the front of the line when it comes to stimulus funds because we have programs that are ready for deployment. We can show our success with past programs. We've got metrics and measures in place so that we can show the effect of what we're doing to move that forward. And so what we've done is we're pulling together a strategic team on really building that framework so that whatever that fund dollar, stimulus dollar might be, we're able then to put it into our system and put it to work throughout the state. And, you know, and again, I can't impress upon you enough the importance of really looking at each of the different regions of the state individually and looking at what their needs are and making sure that we're really providing the needs for those areas. And then what we do at the OWIB is we also have the opportunity to also spread funds more statewide strategically, and so then we're also looking at not just at the local, but also what are we doing across the state. And so then we can make our state, of course, a much more strong place for workforce development. James Sager will talk about this more, but I'd like to talk about just briefly, for this legislative session, the OWIB supports the governor's strategies, investments as proposed for the educational enterprise, workforce education and training. It's a natural part of the enterprise continuum. For the OWIB, highlights of the governor's proposal include investing in the career readiness certificate to better match the skills of the workforce with the employer demand, expanding career technical education to increase the pipeline of skilled workers, adding flexible general funds into the employer workforce training fund, which is now dependent on restricted federal funds, supporting the workforce coordination position in the Economic and Community Development Department. There's much more work that could be done and further investment that could help us reach our strategic goals more quickly. But in this economic environment, the investments the governor has proposed will move us forward and better position Oregon for the future. Thank you very much.
Mr. Paulson, thank you very much. I just want you to know how much we appreciate your time, not only before this subcommittee, but also your service to the state of Oregon. It's critically important for both entities to have people such as yourself who are leaders in industry helping to formulate our state's workforce development policy. And it is a sound policy because, as you had stated, OWIB's focus, and it is the chair's intent for this committee as well, to be focused on the private sector and demand-driven workforce development. And I very much appreciate everything that you do, sir, and the entire Workforce Investment Board. Thank you so much for making yourself available to our subcommittee this morning.
Thank you.
Are there questions or comments for Mr. Paulson before Mr. Sager begins? Yes, Representative Esquivel, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned nursing, and what I found with nursing, discussing it with the people that are not only in the profession but people that teach the profession, that it's an hourglass approach that we have in the state. And what I mean by that is you have the people that want to be in the program up here, you have the people here that can teach the program, and then you have the demand out here. So it's kind of like an hourglass. I keep asking the question over and over again, well, why don't we expand the middle of the hourglass? The reason being is because we don't pay the professors enough money. So my next question is, why not? Why don't we take it upon ourselves to expand that program for the demand, to meet that demand, instead of funneling us down into a fire of an hourglass, get it more of a cylindrical straight shot? And I think that's something that we should work on, not only as a state, but as legislators, to ensure that we do, in fact, meet that demand, because the demand is great in the state for nurses.
Chairman Witt and Representative I'm going to
Escobal.
Escobal. I hope I got
that's okay. I was a sophomore in high school before I could spell it.
You really bring up a great point. And one of the initiatives while at Kaiser that I really moved forward is we moved an internal program where we looked at our workforce. And one of the things with nursing is when you look at the workforce and you see nurses walking out the door with 30 years of experience. And one thing you have to really understand about nursing is about experience. The experience that a nurse has is really much more important than really the education. And so when you have a 30-year nurse walking out the door, you really take a loss. And one of the things that I also want to impress upon you is in nursing, it's a very physically demanding job. And so what we said is we said, you know what? We have these nurses who are very engaged in the work and have this experience, but physically they can't do it. And so we said, let's look at our nurse population and which of our nurse population is ready to move on to become educators. So we did a program where we trained our senior nurses to become educators, and we had a partnership where they would go to the local community college. In this case, it was the Clackamas Community College. They got their training to get trained up to be educators, and then they educated students at the community college half-time. They worked in our facilities for the other half. The organization paid their salary at their current nursing rate, so they took no less pay for the half-time that they were spending as educators. And what we were really trying to do is test a new model and really see how can we make that middle of the hourglass, as you described, how can we make that bigger? And really looking at also leveraging the employees we have. It was very successful, and you know, we have 8 to 12 new educators came out of that. If you look at the Oregon Center for Nursing, they're moving forward programs that really look more specifically at that problem. I've had conversations with them. We partner. The OWIB definitely partners with them and in full support of the work that they're doing around trying to increase the educators so that we are able to somewhat solve that hourglass problem that you bring up.
Okay. Questions from or comments from Representative Demereaux and followed by Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on the subject brought up by my comrade from the fourth floor, I really appreciate those comments about the nursing workforce. Part of the problem is salary, and I think that it is important that you know, the kind of participation that you're talking about. Another one of the challenges has to do with clinicals and training sites, and I think some of the hospitals have been really stepping up to the plate on that. I want to say I really admire the way that the hospitals and the industry has participated in this area. And I think that in many ways it can be a model for other sectors in business and industry in the state. One of the things that that some of the hospitals are doing that I really appreciate are, you know, one of the things is that they're really thinking in terms of pathways for some of their frontline workers, you know, so that you have some of the, you know, the CNAs or, you know, the lower level workers who, you know, very often are from disadvantaged populations. New to this country in some cases, you know, in others, you know, single heads of household, et cetera. And the hospitals are actually supporting them as they are moving up the career ladder. And I think that is really important. And, you know, I'm wondering to what extent the board is looking at that model as a model. And thinking of ways of extending it to other areas, and to what extent industry and other areas really is willing to step up to the plate in this way.
Chair Witt and Representative Demereaux, I'm sorry if I get the names somewhat butchered. Let me talk a little bit first around the piece around upskilling of incumbent workers. Again, when I was at Kaiser Permanente, I'm very passionate about the work, if you can't tell. We really put together a program, and it was exactly as you talked about. I do workforce planning for a living. So when you look at your population, I break the population into pieces, and you have your general population at the bottom of the triangle, then you have professional technical, then management, and then leadership. And when you look at the makeup of those different populations, I saw that in the general population, we had great diversity. And another thing I saw is that I look at what we're paying for tuition reimbursement, and we have a lot of people looking for upskilling on their own. So what we did is we put together a program where we said we're going to take 24 incumbent workers and train them to be nurses. We had the Kaiser system has around 9,000 people in this region. We had over 300 people apply for those 24 spots. Now, you know, getting into Harvard is tough, but this is less than a 10% acceptance rate. We went through and we had a partnership with both the nursing community, labor, and HR on really how we were going to do our selection processes, because that's really important. We put together a cohort that then we moved through. They spent half their time working, half their time going to school. It was an 18-month program they went through that we partnered with, again, Clackamas Community College for the training. One of the very interesting stories that really came out, there was a number of stories of people who, you know, immigrants to this country, first-time college goers, but I thought one of the most poignant stories was when one of the people who was interested in it, they had to go to their supervisor and get a review, a special review. When you had somebody who was going for that program and that supervisor was also going for that program. So the mix of people, both of them got in, by the way, the mix of people that made it into that cohort of 24 was anywhere from people from secretaries to CNAs, supervisors to janitorial staff. And so we had a wide mix. All 24 of those people made it through to becoming nurses. They became their own support structure. And so it really showed that within the organizations, there's a lot of drive to do these things. We said, we're not going to say, oh, after you serve with us, you're going to have to put in 2 years, because you know why? We didn't have to. These are people who love the organization, and now the organization has shown them how much we believe in them, and I don't think we're going to need to worry about them turning over and going across the street. And so that's really an example of how you can move the incumbent worker forward. And that's just an example of some of the things that we're trying to look at across different industries. And so one of the things, when we start talking about, I have to go back to my notes because I want to say it, the Career Readiness Certificate, we want to be able to say, here is a body of workers. And this body of workers is people at this level, people at this level, and people at this level. And we're able, from a development standpoint, to address whatever those individuals' needs are to move them up and have a nationally recognized, statewide deployed means of evaluating. So when an employer comes looking for a place to expand their business, grow their business, they can say, what does the workforce look like? Instead of saying, well, there's an unemployment rate like this, there's an educational level like this, we can say much more succinctly, we have folks that are trained at this level that are ready for these types of jobs, and we have folks at this level that are ready for these types of jobs. Because let's understand, the goal, when we say high demand, high wage jobs, okay, a lot of times you need to start at an entry job that can build toward a future. And I think that that's a key point that we need to really look at, is getting people into jobs that then can lead to careers. And what we can do for incumbent workers is very important on really trying to move that forward as well.
Representative Polby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. this is really encouraging hearing what you're having to say about training the incumbent worker. I don't know if the chair remembers, but as Representative Esquivel explained about this hourglass situation, this committee 2 years ago had the ONA president, I believe Susan King, and somebody from Providence Hospital up here. And I brought up to them that recognizing that same issue of having this resource, this human capital, if you will, of really experienced nurses who were burning out because of staffing levels or whatever the case may be, or just, you know, the incredible physicalness of their jobs, and they were disappearing out of the system and going, I'm done being a charge nurse, I'm done being an administrator, I'm done at this level, I'm going to go back and draw blood and just put in my 8 hours and go home. And so we had this huge resource that was able to get into educating that workforce. We didn't have any teachers to teach these people, and they're right in our own hospitals.
Yep.
And so utilizing that, I'm just so encouraged to hear that somebody's, you know, picked that up and is running with it. It's just great news. And I might add that I'm glad we also recognize that, and your organization's recognized that somehow we got to keep their pay up, otherwise there's no incentive for them to go into this educating position. And certainly, you know, we need, you know, increased budgets to make sure that we can pay the instructors and the professors and the teachers to do that. And, of course, increased budgets means we need increased revenue as well. So I know we all agree to that. So anyway, thank you.
Thank you.
I, too, would like to just comment on how important it is for the organization to have that commitment to its workforce. I think that probably the greatest economic epoch in recent history in our nation has been post-World War II, when there was a social contract. And there was a commitment between both the organization or the employer as well as the workforce. And I think we've lost a lot of that social contract of recent. And I think you have shown that it works, and that a mutual commitment is to the advantage of both parties, and there is so much to be gained from that. So I commend you and thank you for that.
Thank you.
Can I just ask one more question?
Yes, Representative Dembro, please.
Thank you, Chair. So we've kind of touched on this with respect to the healthcare workforce, but, you know, in general, the subject of retention of workforce, of skilled workforce, is that something that OIB looks at in a kind of general way? I mean, you know, our focus has been on training and bringing people into the workforce, but, you know, the nurses are one example of challenges that we face keeping people in the workforce. And is that something that you all are working on?
Yeah, definitely, because when you look at manufacturing as an example, further back in my career, I spent a lot of time working in manufacturing as well. And one of the things is, when you look at manufacturing, one of the key pieces is really looking at who's going to be next. Because when you work at a manufacturing facility, you have machines that have been there, you know, 30, 40, 50 years in a lot of cases. And it's not as though you pull out the manual and fix it. Right? And so it's very key, especially from a maintenance standpoint, to keep the plant running. And so what's very important is being, again, it's the transfer of that knowledge. And so one of the things that we really, and I only touched on it briefly, is really looking at youth apprenticeships and really trying to get that next group of workers in there. And so then we can start transferring that, because this transfer of knowledge, it takes years. Literally years. When you talk to some of the folks that are represented on our board and the numerous boards across the state, and they talk about, we're going to need welders, we're going to need machine operators, you know, that's not tomorrow necessarily, but when they look 3, 5, 10 years out, you got to start planning that workforce today to start moving them into those roles. And one of the things when you talk about manufacturing, manufacturing is not glamorous to today's youth. So we go out there, and one of the things that we're doing from our communications committee is really looking at how can we use some of the new media to have a new conversation with this youth so then we can say, okay, you're not going to be LeBron James, but you know what? You can make a very good living working in manufacturing in a number of different fields to give them that exposure and then have those pathways available so someone can say, here's a program where I can get the skills, the training that I need so I can go after that. And so that's really our contribution to the coming need in a field such as manufacturing.
Yes, Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up of what you just hit on, and you say it's not glamorous to be in manufacturing. I think that, and this is what I, this is my own personal opinion, but I think that's being drilled into our children in a K through 12 system that's all orientated toward college. That if you don't go to college, you've more or less missed the boat. And I think that's something that we need to turn around, is that mindset. Because, you know, I have some friends that are plumbers that make tons of money, a lot more than some college graduates ever thought of making. Mm-hmm. I have some friends that are builders, electricians. These people are very talented. They're very intelligent. But they didn't want to go to college. And that's 82% of the population that go into high school, never go to college or graduate out of college. So why do we gear everything towards college being the goal, and if you don't achieve that, you're a failure kind of attitude? I think that's something that we need to work on as a whole with our educational system, is that, you know, a plumber makes a lot more than, let's say, a school teacher or in some cases professors or whatever, that we need to let people know that there are room for every one of our youth, that they have an opportunity to earn a great living, that all they have to do is have the basic math skills, communication skills, and they can be quite successful in life.
Chair Witt and Representative Esquivel, you're absolutely right. And you'll see that one of the things that we're moving forward is expanding the career technical education, and it's really building strong partnerships with, you know, the local community colleges and really seeing what types of technical training can we provide to youth to help move them along, help them understand there's another path. You don't have to work in an office and that sort of thing. And so we're definitely aware of that, and we really are, that's again, trying to really raise the exposure of the much broader opportunities out there. And I know that James Sager can talk more specifically about the legislative pieces that we're trying to move forward as well.
I noticed that one of the things that you discussed was the community college manufacturing certificate, and our committee's report had said from the previous session that we recommended the state institute a portable work readiness certificate that affirms individual job seekers have demonstrated the knowledge and skills needed for successful performance as entry-level workers. And I'm just curious, has there been enough time that's passed for you to be able to analyze the acceptance that the employer community has had for this certificate and whether they view it as useful?
I'm going to turn that over to James because he's a little closer to it.
Chair Wood, members of the committee, yes, we have. I mean, there are several pieces that would relate to that statement. First of all, with the help of the investment board and the workforce policy cabinet and all the agencies that have been working with us, the direction was to not simply look at entry level, but really be able to identify, as Mr. Paulson mentioned in his testimony, identify the continuum of skill sets so people from 17 to 77 can have some sort of documentation that demonstrates that they have the skills necessary to do a job. So the Career Readiness Certificate really meets that need. We have been piloting that program the last several months, and we're moving into full implementation. It's in the governor's budget to do that. What has been quite amazing is oftentimes, you know, you roll out a new idea and everyone kind of sits back on the sideline and waits to see if someone else decides it's okay. We have been overwhelmed with requests from the business community to say, more or less, it's about time you had something like this. And a couple ways this has been demonstrated. A company here just in the last couple months had 8 openings. It was in manufacturing. They had 400 people apply for these 8 openings. We put a cohort of those applicants through the basic assessment for the Career Readiness Certificate. And so out of that pool, the company interviewed quite a few of them. They said not only was this the best pool of applicants they ever had, but the 8 people they hired, they were just thrilled because we gave them a way to filter people that was different than the traditional, did you have, you know, your PhD or did you have something else, but really looking at the application. We also have businesses that are now using the system to advance people within their company. So if they want to advance or move departments, again, they can be assessed. And it doesn't say that you know how to run that lathe. It says you have the skill sets necessary to learn how to run that lathe. And that's what businesses are looking for, not just having, you know, had on the job, but they will provide the on the job. So that works. The manufacturing certificate that James mentioned was looking at the skill sets, kind of the base level skill sets that cross the manufacturing industries, and identify those so that we can make sure that, again, whether high school youth or adults, we can identify, do you have those skill sets, or here are the programs that you can attend to acquire those skill sets that then make you eligible for either entry or advancement. And so we've made a great deal of progress in the last 2 years.
Fantastic. Well, I think this is a prime example of something that the public sector can do to assist the private sector and to bolster our economy and to get the workers into the positions that the private sector has that demand need for. And into those jobs, as Representative Esquivel has pointed out, are the high-paying jobs and the backbone of our economy. So just a tremendous example. Thank you.
Yes, Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Chair. James, or Chair Witt, anybody, Norm Eder and his work on Manufacturing 21, have we been integrating that into the investment board work? Is there any cooperation between...
Chair Witt, Representative Huffman, yes, I mean, we Manufacturing 21, a number of associations and interest groups have been working both through the local boards and through the state board. So again, we're trying to prevent turf wars, and we're trying to establish real cooperation.
Fantastic.
Yes.
Just one question. I think maybe you already said this, but I just wanted to reiterate or hear your point of view on this. In your cooperation with other state agencies, specifically economic development, for example, were they really targeted, you know, certain specific high-wage, high-skill cluster type of areas that they and many others, I think, you know, the Innovation Council and all these other people are looking at saying this is really where we need to focus our investment on this particular green technology, or whether it's Onami, or whether it's, you know, a cluster group of piece of our economy. Do we see that coordination with the investments from the OWIB monies going towards that same sort of goal, so that we're really leveraging our investments that we're making through the economic development along with workforce and development and education and so on and so on?
Yeah, let me give my point of view, and then James can kind of follow up. That's really one of the key things, is because we really see that workforce development goes hand-in-hand with economic development. And so what we're really trying to do is make stronger alliances between that, whether it's from a local level or whether it's from the state level. And where you can really see it kind of really making a difference is up in the Portland metro area where I live, when you look at when a company comes, the PDC, which is the economic development driver up there, they come and they talk to us and say, we need workforce information. We need to be able to provide this information to company X that's looking at locating here. And that's where we really have a strong partnership so that we're able to play together, so to speak. When we start talking from a larger state and organizational side of things, I think James could talk to that more effectively.
Representative Witt, Representative Holvey, yes, we have the Workforce Policy Cabinet, which is our representatives then from all the state agencies that are connected, including economic development. We meet on a monthly basis, both in preparation to meet with the OWIB Executive Committee, but then also to make sure that we're coordinating our efforts. It is also why the governor has proposed in his budget the creation of a position in the Economic Development Department whose focus will be workforce, so that we make sure we are having a tight alignment between what the economic development folks are hearing is needed from the businesses they're helping to recruit and expand, and what the education training side is able to deliver. Hopefully we can begin to anticipate actions that we need to take, as opposed to always being reactionary. A good example is the Winsmith, the renewable energy approach. I mean, we're working with our community colleges especially to look at how we can expand their programs, and trying to anticipate not just we need, say, for instance, the Winsmith, but what's the next level of training or job that is going to come along because we've just expanded this industry over here. So it is trying, like I say, to be more futuristic looking as opposed to simply reactionary.
Follow up, please. And so along those same veins, when we're talking about, you know, apprenticeship and pre-apprenticeship so we're working together with the Apprenticeship and Training Division, with BOLI and the Employment Department and community colleges, to make sure that, you know, we're not really having this duplication of efforts, that we're working together.
Again, Chair Witt, Representative Holvey, BOLI is a part of the Workforce Policy Cabinet, and again, are always invited to attend the either Executive Committee or the full OWIB. So we have tried to align all the sectors, including DHS, that has many workforce-connected components, employment, et cetera. We're all at the table trying to coordinate these efforts.
Great. Representative Holvey, one of the things that I inferred from what Mr. Paulson said, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, sir, but I think one of the things that I deduced from what you were talking about was that perhaps some of the federal funds are more siloed than our state money, and that it, as important as those federal funds are, critically important, that we have a little bit more flexibility to do some of the things that we would like to get accomplished here, perhaps more at a local level with our state funding.
Chairman Witt, you're absolutely correct. Those federal funds come with many strings attached. And just managing through those federal funds in and of itself takes a certain degree of technical artwork. And so being able to deliver on the federal expectations while you're also looking at the needs of your community is very challenging, and something that both the local and the state level we are challenged with. And that's why looking at more of the general funds, and so we could be much more trying to think of the word, but open to opportunities and how we can really kind of move the workforce development conversation forward. And that's one of the things that why we're pushing for some of the legislation that we have, because if we had that ability, I think that you'd see that we could deliver on a lot of different programs for the state. Because when you're looking at the federal funds, you know, they're chopped up. It's like, this is just for dislocated workers, this is just for youth, and it's very difficult on how you have to look at someone who comes for services for you. You know, a lot of times, you know, we have to deal with populations that are challenged at the local level. You know, English as a second language, reading, math ability, and we need to definitely provide for those people in our community. And we also need to look at how we can bring them along and bring them up into positions where they can be successful, because it is about our entire community, and we are definitely not only focusing at, you know, the top end of the spectrum, so to speak. And so we need to make sure that we have funding sources that are consistent and long-term, federal funds consistently over the last 3-5 years that I've been involved in this work have been declining significantly year over year. We see that these stimulus dollars are a great opportunity, but we're definitely not looking at them as being a long-term funding source. It's kind of a, we're taking it as, it's a one-time thing, and if it happens again, great. But we also know that stimulus dollars mean that the economy is really challenged, and that's not where we want to be long term. Where we really want to be long term is we want to continue the federal funding, and hopefully that they make that much more stable. But we also want to look at what opportunities we have from the state level to enhance the work that we're doing.
Thank you very much. Yes, Representative Dimbrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Addressing the stimulus package, you know, one of the things that you mentioned that I appreciated very much was the idea of being very planful and strategic, ready for when those dollars flow, and you know, making sure that those dollars are well deployed around the state and that they're going to be used to produce family wage jobs and ideally jobs that have futures to them, so people are, you know, they're not jobs that are going to be here today and gone tomorrow, as much as possible. The challenge, I think, is going to be the oversight of that, right? I mean, I think it's really important to have a plan in place. And maybe this is more of a question for James Sager, but how are we going to make sure that those dollars are being spent on family wage jobs that really have potential to grow a community?
Chair Witt, Representative Dimbrough, that's a very good question. And working, again, with both the state board and the local boards, the governor directed the state board to establish a tighter oversight process and approval process of the local plans. So the governor, again, recognizes that it's the locals that really understand what they need in their communities. And so he's challenging them, put together robust plans. But those plans have to come to the state board for review. The timeline right now is they need to be into the executive committee by April so that they can be approved by the full board by June and out the door, the money out the door. So we have a tight timeline, but again, it is to get the money moving quickly, but at the same time have oversight. The governor has directed that whether it be the funds in the Economic Development Department, the new funds he's trying to make available for workforce, or the WIA money, to have that those funds focused on the four strategic areas: healthcare, manufacturing, clean, renewable energy jobs, and those high regional high-wage, high-demand jobs. So it's very, I'll say easy, but there's an awful lot of work that has gone into it and will move forward. But easy for the OWIB to now look at what those plans are coming, how that aligns with the data from their region, and connects then with those four priorities, and also then align up with the new career readiness certificate and the other methodologies that we're rolling out. So the OWIB has been very responsive to the governor's request, and we believe that this will be a solid oversight process for us.
Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we could probably dovetail that into your regional economic development, because they they statistically take care of that in the region anyway, whatever region they're responsible for, on how many family wage jobs they have, what the average is, retention, expansion, the whole nine yards there. And I think that would be a good, I don't think we have to reinvent the wheel on that.
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, you're absolutely right. We're not reinventing the wheel. We're utilizing in a more coordinated way the systems that we already have in place. And what is exciting about this work and the fantastic work that the Employment Department has done is we're getting to the point that with our data systems, not only are we able to say, yeah, these are the high-wage, high-demand jobs in the area, but we're going to, well, we are technically able to focus down almost by zip code and say, employer, there are 17 people in this zip code area that have the skill sets that you're looking for. And we can get those people to you. So that is the we're no longer just waiting for people to come in the door. We can actually be proactive in making the connections between what the employer needs and what the workforce capabilities are.
Thank you very much. James, did you have additional prepared remarks?
Well, Chair Witt, thank you for that. If you would just give me a few minutes to just kind of highlight a few things, because Representative Esquivel kind of commented about something that the governor has spoken about a lot over the last 6 years, and that is this country and our society has done a rather poor job of recognizing and honoring the work that people do in our society and the need for skilled workers to pick up the tools, to build the things, to keep the machines running, to that are the real drivers behind our economy. And the message nationally, and if you look at all the state national reports that come out on a regular basis, it's all focused on the college prep or the college transition focus, which in Oregon, 80% of the jobs that we can project available over the next 10 years, they require training and education beyond high school, but they don't require four-year degrees. And so, and when he has traveled around the state and talked to students that are struggling to complete high school or have dropped out of high school, the majority of the time, these are very intelligent, able young people, but they saw no relevance between the education they were receiving and what they wanted to do. And so he has been pushing real hard to expand career technical ed and make the connection between the high schools and the community colleges so that, in fact, we're providing those opportunities to people, not only from the standpoint of acquiring those skills, but hopefully having those skills developed that reflect the economy in their area so that they can stay in their communities and they can add to the economic base in the community as well as raise their families and everything else in those communities. So the governor has been very focused on that and believes that that both his message and the message from the new administration has really started to focus again back on the value and like I say, the honor of these jobs and this training. It's with that in mind that the governor proposed the three of the items that he proposed specifically for workforce. Mr. Paulson mentioned the career readiness certificate, because we think that that is going to be a major bridge not only between the high school student and the workforce, but then, like I say, the adult workforce and the work that's out there. The career technical education expansion at the community colleges, where we've said in order to have access to these funds, you need to reach back into your high schools and coordinate with them and coordinate with the workforce investment boards in your area to identify that, in fact, you're providing the kinds of training that makes that connection. And also, he has been pushing for the education system to not only expand dual credit programs around career technical ed, but also looking at applied baccalaureates, that in fact this can be a pathway that people over time decide that they do in fact want to complete a four-year degree, but they want that four-year degree in a particular area of their interest. And the other is the workforce employer workforce training fund, because we do need to be able to respond quicker with greater flexibility to companies around the state that have training needs that the federal dollars don't allow us to help. So those issues are very important. As you heard from Mr. Paulson, the governor a few years ago asked the board to shrink their size from 40 to now 24, but after the fine work that Commissioner Avakian did in kind of analyzing the workforce system in Oregon, two major proposals came forward to the governor from the commissioner. One is to again look at the makeup of the board, and so the governor has asked the board to again, you know, kind of that reflection of, is this the best system that we could have? Are there different people that we need on the board? We have made over the years some very, what we thought at the time, strategic decisions to add particular people to the board. Maybe times are that we need to change. So the governor's waiting for that response. The other directive from the governor, as I mentioned, was this coordination and oversight. Both of those proposals came to him from the commissioner, and so the governor's very pleased with that work. We believe that, in fact, the coordination is coming together. I think what you've seen today, and you can see why we're so pleased with people like James and others that serve on the board that have such background and passion for this, that they would, that they have helped with this work. But I think what is becoming more clear to many of us is that there's an awful lot of fine work going on behind the scenes that we just don't understand how all this came together, but there's a great deal of coordination with the OWIB board, with the Workforce Policy Cabinet, and others to make this, again, a much more responsive, nimble process and one that helps Oregonians find and maintain competitive jobs and family wage jobs in this state.
Thank you very much. Committee members, generally the chair chooses to ask his questions last, but I'm driven by our committee's agenda, and with your indulgence, I'm going to move some questioning about one of our committee bills to the forefront here, since we have an opportunity with James Sager to ask those. You may remember past committee members, and I mentioned this in our last meeting, that we have a couple of committee bills that came out of the last session. One of those describes the reorganization of OWIB, and I think we were on the cutting edge when we made those recommendations, but as by nature of the legislature being out of session, in essence, for 18 months out of every 2 years, sometimes we fall behind the curve. And I think the OWIB and the governor's office has entertained a number of the ideas that our committee has put forward. And I would just like to take this opportunity to ask some questions so that as committee members we can begin that sort process. What were our recommendations? What's already been achieved? What does the governor's office anticipate achieving in the near future? And then what remains for our committee's recommendations? So with that, James, I know that our committee recommendation is for 19 voting members and two non-voting members. Mr. Paulson's already noted that there's been a significant reduction in the number of OWIB members. Can you assist our committee on just where we are?
Sure, Chair Witt. As I mentioned just a moment ago, the governor, even though we have it down to 24, the governor has asked the board to again go back, look at their makeup, and bring back to him any specific adjustments. There are some problems with the 17 member request, and that is because there are federal mandates that are in place. Now, we can request waivers to those, and we have actually, even in the governor's request to reduce from 40 to 24 and have, in essence, all of the state agencies represented by one person at the full board, technically we should probably have asked for a waiver, but we believe that if in fact anyone were to call us on that, we could justify, you know, why we're operating that way. But there are some things that the governor has made a decision over the years, and the board has made a decision over the years to add an additional, for instance, labor voice on the board, to add, because we don't have a community college system. We have 17 community colleges who collaborate with us on activities. We've added a community college president to the board. We've also added a K-12 youth provider, an ESD representative who she actually oversees youth programs, workforce programs. So there have been these kind of strategic decisions made over the years. And so the governor has asked the OWIP to go back, review those, look at, do we have the right people? Do they represent the right industries, et cetera, on the board? And we're giving the board time to reflect on that and come back. If either changes that the governor determines needs to be made to the board, or if additional direction needs to be given to the board around this coordination and approval process with the local plans, both of those items are in the bill. If they require an executive order, the governor's prepared to do that. At this point, we have had such positive response and reaction from the OWIB board, we believe we're moving in the right direction to complete both of those. Some of the other items in the two bills that have been brought up have rather substantial fiscal impacts. And so they were not included in the governor's proposal because obviously we did not have the resources. One I would like to highlight is the summer youth program, youth employment program. We know both the Senate and House versions of the federal stimulus plan include funding for just that effort. So again, in the planning that we've already begun with the local boards, it is to be ready to ramp that up this summer when those federal dollars come in. So again, we're finding ways to kind of carry out the ideas, but it's just not using state resources because those are not available. If there are other specifics in the bill you'd like me to address, be happy to.
Actually, what I'd like to do is make a request.
Sure.
I've asked our committee administrator already to, in essence, begin an analysis of what our recommendations were. And if I could ask you to perhaps work with Kevin, and maybe we could do kind of a side-by-side comparison of what our committee's recommendations are and what the governor's office is envisioning, then we will know what's left in terms of our recommendations. And I think, committee members, that would make our work a lot easier. Mm-hmm. And I am, frankly, very reticent to move a bill forward that is prescribing things that have already been done. Frankly, I just think that's embarrassing, so if nothing else. And so if you could begin that work, it would be very helpful to us.
Chairman Witt, we'd be happy to, and we've already done quite a bit of analysis, so we can sit down with Kevin. We can probably crank this out pretty quickly.
And if we could get that done perhaps before we actually hear those bills and have that passed out to our committee members, then I think we can be up to speed before we have the hearing on the bills and know exactly where we're going at that point.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you very much.
By 10.
10:30.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Committee members, questions or comments? Yes,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dembro.
Thank you. You know, going back to the question of encouraging students to go into the trades and manufacturing, one of the things that really struck me during the process of moving the state towards new graduation requirements for high school was the realization that What it takes to be successful in skilled trades today, given new technologies, is really not much different than what it than the skill level needed to go to college, right? So, I think that there may be a misperception out there that in encouraging students to go the skilled trades route, we're encouraging them to pursue a lesser level of skill when they're in high school. And I wonder if you could address that, James. And
Chair Witten, Representative Dembro, I'd be happy to, because I think where the disconnect comes is understanding the relevance and relationship of the programs. If you look at the skill sets necessary, we need people that can problem solve, that can analyze, that can think through a process to come to a conclusion. If you look at mathematics, for instance, which is the area that is oftentimes identified, going to college for the most part, or going to a university, requires more theoretical mathematics. What has been missing has been that applied mathematics. So you can get at the values and essence of geometry through applied mathematics without maybe learning all the different theorems and, you know, kind of the more the abstract approach, or understanding algebraic process without having to worry about A plus B equals the square root of, and think of those formulas. So it really is looking at the path that the student, and again, when I say student, student of all ages, but you're talking about high school, what they're interested in, and then making sure that we're showing that relevance and that relationship for that student so they see the connection. So it's not a lower standard at all. In fact, one of the interesting outcomes of this new career readiness certificate assessment. We had a group of high school students who had completed the traditional college entrance exams. And so we knew what their scores were on that. We had them take the career readiness certificate. In many cases, those that did exceptionally well on the more theoretical college entrance struggled with the applied, and those that did fine but didn't do as well on the theoretical really shined on the applied. So you know, we all think differently, we all look at approaches differently, and so that really shows that they're equal, but it's just a different methodology.
Mm-hmm. And if I could just follow up, and you know, given the funding challenges that we face now, and the at least some people calling for us postponing the higher requirements in the area of applied math, do you see problems flowing from that?
Chair Witt, Representative Dembro, what the governor had asked the state board to do was to review their timeline to make sure that the state was providing the resources necessary to provide students the opportunity to meet the new expectation. Recognizing that, in fact, there may need to be new staff, additional staff, a differently trained staff in order to provide these opportunities. And so the board has been grappling with that challenge. What the governor does not want to do is once again set up a system that's either destined to fail because we don't support it, or that the broader community kind of reacts by, well, this too will pass, but something that we can actually implement and support and students benefit from. What I'm hearing from education colleagues around the state is that they are very excited about the idea of looking at this applied methodology. And so if we're able to support professional development and planning and training time for staff members, I think that a lot of that effort will move forward, but it may not be able to move forward at quite the pace that we had hoped for.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Indulging me, one question. James, it was a couple months ago, I think I kind of floated by a concept by you, and that concept that I'm working on, and just kind of wondering what your thoughts are about it, because as we're looking at a training education fund, whether it's the one that's identified with OWEB or some other fund, you know, our critical problem is getting those resources into place so that we can provide this training that needs to happen. And I kind of floated an idea out that basically would require, I'm picking a number that I haven't decided on, but a nickel an hour for employers who are receiving economic development funds or workforce grants, or they're receiving tax abatements through enterprise zones where they are required to have a certain amount of employees by law in creating jobs. And so they're getting this public stimulus basically to bring our workforce forward to help create jobs. But yet there's nothing going back into the system to build that infrastructure we need. So I'm just kind of curious whether you've given that any thought or whether you've discussed that with the governor at all. And
Chair Witt,
how would that be received, do you think?
Representative Holvey, yes, we have discussed this idea. The governor is always interested in creative ways to make resources available for education and training for people. I think that your idea not only brings in the kind of that broader business collaboration like we heard in the nursing area from Mr. Paulson, but also brings the unions into the picture, and we need to work very closely with the unions to make sure that those quality training programs are available. And I know that the Carpenters Union and some others have really stepped up and tried to make that connection. If I might, just as an aside, to tie that with the career readiness certificate I mentioned, the sheet metal workers are now requiring, in the certificate, you're in a gold, bronze, silver, gold level. The sheet metal union is requiring their apprentice applicants to have at least met the silver level of skill sets. So providing resources to allow more Oregonians to have access to those kinds of training programs. As I say, the governor is always interested in those ideas.
Mm-hmm. Anything further, members, for this panel? Not seeing or hearing anything. Gentlemen, thank you so much. And before you leave, Mr. Paulson, you have the take-home quote for today. Our state's economy rests on the skills of its workforce. Thank you so very much, sir.
Thank you.
Just so that everyone knows where we're headed, at this point, I'm intending to call Dr. Tota back up. Before I do, just know that we're going to have a very brief discussion on any legislative proposals that came out of our weekend's review of the committee's report, and I know that Representative Esquivel has a suggestion for a potential committee bill, and I've talked with a couple of you individually, and I think that we're all in sync on that. So, Vice Chair Huffman, if you'd like to call our next witness up, please.
First, thank you, Mr. Sager and Mr. Paulson, and support here, Mr. White. These guys could have gone on several hours about the work that's going on in the background and policy and direct things from the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, the mycareerpath.com and .org, and a lot of neat things that are happening. So thanks for that. And I'm privileged to have two of my constituents here, Dr. Keller and Dr. Tota. I don't know if you both want to come up and answer some questions. Ernie, you're on the College Board. Is that correct? And Dr. Tota is the president of Columbia Gorge Community College. So why don't you come on up? And I know I had kind of out of place started asking some questions earlier, but I knew that it would probably spur other questions. So I appreciate you coming to answer some questions for us. Dr. Tota and Dr. Keller are the boots on the ground, the front line, doing a lot of this stuff that we're talking about at policy level, and this is the action plan that's in work, and they can address specifically what's going on at Columbia Gorge Community College. And if you would like, Representative Esquivel, Dr. Tota could also address your idea if you wanted to kind of launch a little bit of that as far as integrating or the cooperation between high school and community colleges, because again, they have a successful program. Dr. Tota could also address the hourglass situation with nursing, because Columbia Gorge has a nursing program. They also have the renewable energy wind technician program. So Dr. Tota could address questions about a lot of the things that we've been footballing around this morning. So welcome, and identify yourself for the record, and thanks for coming.
For the record, my name is Dr. Frank Tota, president of Columbia Gorge Community College. Chair Witt, Representative Huffman, pleasure to be here. The priority on my brain right now is the three cups of coffee I drank before I came in here. And, so I will be very brief and to the point. We toyed with the idea of stepping up here and say the reason we're here, sir, is to request some way to fund Columbia Gorge's wind tech program for $2 million. And for doing that, we would return $8 million next year in terms of return on that investment. But I thought better of that in terms of some of the questions that were asked earlier during the testimony. I think it would be very, very useful if I just provided, and I wasn't prepared to give testimony today, but I ran out to my car here and I grabbed some materials that I always carry with me, and I'd like to just sort of talk through these materials with you, and I think that would be very useful as background.
Thank you very much.
The first document that I'm sending up is a document that we hand out to our students that are interested in wind technology. And this is part of our Pathways Initiative. As you may or may not know, the State Pathways Director is located at Columbia Gorge Community College for a lot of reasons, one of them being we've been very, very aggressive in the whole Pathways Initiative statewide in terms of linking job training to high schools, taking folks off the unemployment rolls, and I could go on and on and on about that. So again, if this looks like a Pathways document, it is, and it's very straightforward. It says you start with the basics with a 2.5 GPA, you can get a one-year certificate, a two-year associate's degree, and I lied to you earlier when I said the range is 18 to 30. I'm getting hard of seeing here. It's actually $18 to $36 an hour. And again, this is a very colorful document that we hand out. It's very brief, very to the point, and the focus is come to this program, you'll get yourself a job, and it'll be a job that rewards you well. Some of the more specific questions. The document that I'm providing to you now is a document that we've been using in Washington, D.C. And what this is it's a proposal to create a national model for wind technology training. And we based this package on an initiative that we began in summer of last year. We've been doing wind training now for about 2 years. And this last summer, the American Wind Energy Association asked our college to put together a conference of all wind companies, all wind trainers in the United States. And we did that. We had a summit in the Columbia Gorge. And as a result of that, we developed some common training outcomes for wind technology and renewable energy training. As a result of that discussion, the American Wind Energy Association has asked us to consider developing a national model for wind technology training. And I apologize if I'm being long-winded here. I'm trying to be very focused. So we're moving forward with that with a great deal of energy. We were working with Senator Smith and Senator Wyden together jointly. They actually have draft congressional legislation in process that would form regional training centers in the area of renewable energy training. And the concept there is there are hundreds of millions of dollars being spent across the nation on developing programs, when in fact there are programs like we have here in Oregon that are already up and running, already approved by the American Wind Energy Association. And so we've asked for that consideration. The amount of funding that we're asking for is everything from $60 million, I think was the most recent proposal, to $200 million, I think, is currently written into the congressional wording. We are now working with Senator Merkley on that discussion. He has expressed a great deal of interest in it, and so we've spent a significant energy getting him up to speed. He's going to come visit us in February. We are going back in March to give congressional testimony. Again, it's something that our college has been very, very focused on. You're probably wondering, what does a community college have to do with this type of initiative? And part of the answer is we look at it as more than education. We look at it as an opportunity for Oregon. We look at it in terms of dealing with a huge job need in the state of Oregon in terms of wind energy training. Right now we're predicting that we're about 500 workers short in the renewable energy training arena, and the wind companies have stepped forward and asked us to do something about it. We've been working with the other community colleges in Oregon in terms of sharing our curriculum and moving that forward, and as a result, we have moved our baby 18 students in terms of capacity to 36. We hope to move that to 70 a year. We're moving forward with the expectation that the investment will be there. With all the bad news about the budget cuts running around, we just had an all-day work session last week in which myself and my executive team made the determination that now would not be the time to start cutting our budgets, especially in the renewable energy area. And so we are moving forward with the expectation that somehow, some way, either from private contributions from our wind tech partners or from the state or from the federal government, the funds will be there to flesh out this fully developed program. So again, just kind of a 50,000 foot level of where we are. We actually built this program on our nursing program. The connection there is that 3 years ago, the Columbia Gorge Nursing Program was identified as the Department of Labor National Model for Rural Healthcare Training. And the reason for that was the way that we put together all the healthcare partners in terms of a funding agreement, where they're actually providing us support for our program and with real dollars and with loan faculty. And by doing that, we were able to draft some additional funding from the feds and put together a Department of Labor grant in which they provided us the funding to grow us to the level where we are today. Another discussion. We then took that and built that into a WinTech program, same kind of strategy, same kind of partnership approach, and that's where we are today.
Chair Witch.
I will quit talking.
I know there are a lot of questions up here. We just touched on this the other day, and Representative Hovey was talking about public-private partnerships, and I gave a couple of examples. And,
yes, sir.
And I think you have done an excellent job. And,
thank you.
And so Representative Hovey may have questions. I'm sure others do, too, but thank you.
Representative Hovey?
Oh, question.
How did we do it?
No, I think it's a great initiative, you know, to be focused on this green technology. I'm sort of curious, though, on your specifics around, you know, your training and whatnot. And have you been in collaboration with you know, apprenticeship and training division again with the type of training you're doing? And specifically, I'm kind of curious about how you might, are you utilizing or working with the
the training programs are centered around turbines, because on the Columbia Gorge, I assume, we have millwrights, I believe, are, you know, work on these turbines on the dams and have been for, you know, about a century or so, and they have training programs. Or so, are you working with them on and collaborating and utilizing those resources?
The short answer is no, we are not. But the longer answer is yes, we are. And the reason I'm going both directions here is that when we put together this WinTech program, we actually based it on a power generation program that we had at one time. One time we had the largest electrical engineering training program in the state. And the reason being is we've got the dams right there, and we had a partnership with the local power operators. And we were actually taking folks, you know, and running them through our training program, and then they would start work at Bonneville Power, at the Dallas Dam, at John Day. And somewhere in that process, we got crosswise politically with a number of folks. And to make a long story short, we found ourselves spending a lot of energy on that. So we did a reset, and we went in the direction of wind technology. But we used the same basic relationships, the same basic skill sets, and when we got our wind tech program approved through the state, if you looked at it very closely, you would say, this looks very much like a combination of a manufacturing training program and the electrical engineering training program, which we were very proud of at one point in time. I don't know if that answers your question. We have moved so quickly. The wind technology companies are putting up wind towers as fast as they can, as they can go. It's every time you turn around, there's a new wind tower. So the whole subject of apprenticeships, union relationships, it is not been one of those subject areas of discussion. Where we're at right now is a crisis. I need technicians. I need them now. And so we have engaged with the wind companies. They actually developed our curriculum. We got together with six wind companies, and through many, many meetings, we developed a core curriculum that would prepare an individual coming into the program to go to work for any of the wind technician companies in Oregon and Washington and Idaho now.
So do these, follow up, Mr. Chair? So these programs work with the established manufacturers of the turbines themselves?
Well, some of the wind companies are both manufacturers and operators. They're currently installing them. Some of the companies are then spinning them off into operations groups. Just to give you kind of a data point, 2 years ago we went to the American Wind Energy Conference, and there must have been probably 60 people that were really interested in what we were doing. Last year we went, they had 11,000 people show up at the conference. They had to move the conference to be able to handle the conference. And what I'm saying here is people like Vestas, they're manufacturers, but they're also operators. But their job is to get out of that business as soon as they can. So there are other companies being formed that actually operate the installed devices, PGE, Suzlon, Iberdrola, the list is very long. It's an area that has literally grown up overnight, and I'm not sure that because it has grown up so quickly that the psyche of Oregon has actually captured the size of this renewable energy activity in the state of Oregon. We, again, as a community, have spent a lot of time in Washington because we think that it's an opportunity to take Oregon to a national level. We
Washington, D.C.
Washington, D.C., I'm sorry.
And Washington State.
And Washington State. We've put together a bi-state energy training zone, if you will, working with Washington State. And, again, we're right now in the stage of trying to build that into a national training model. Doing that does two things. It addresses the huge shortfall of technicians, but then it also brings business to Oregon, and that's one of the exciting things that we're focused on.
Vice Chair Huffman, probably the last question, because I want to give Representative Esquivel some time
here. Yeah, I was actually going to try to segue here, okay, if I could, Mr. Chair, because I know that Dr. Tota could go on for a couple more hours.
And I apologize.
No, very, very informational, and thank you for that. But I know the relationship between high schools and community colleges. And
exciting area.
Representative Esquivel has an idea, and I know you could share a lot about your model also.
Well, if Representative Esquivel would allow me, I'd like to just share just a few sound bites of what we are doing with our high schools, and in particular with regard to wind technology training. One of the challenges that we face, especially in rural Oregon, is building dreams in the hearts and minds of the children that are coming through high school. There's just, in many cases, a sense of, I don't have a place to go, I don't have a way to move on. And so one of the things we did early on is, and by early on was in 2002 and 2003, we began actually teaching community college courses in the high schools. And the way we did this is we worked with some of the high schools. We asked for the faculty, the volunteer to be college faculty. And so they're not only the teacher at the high school, but they're also the faculty at Columbia Gorge Community College. And the conversation began to expand, and today we've got, I've lost the most recent number, but it's hundreds of students that are currently enrolled in high school taking a class, and that class is not advanced placement. It's actually a Columbia Gorge Community College class taught in the high school by a high school teacher who is a dual qualified faculty member at the college. And by that dual enrollment, we're actually beginning to see high school students who are beginning to go, well, I got a future. I'm going to college, and so I can do something with my life. We've tied that to our Pathways Initiative in terms of focusing it in specific areas like renewable energy. We think that's the future, but also healthcare training. One of the exciting things that I'm seeing now is those students when they walk across in graduation day, and I like to pick them out because they've gone through the work of not only graduating from high school, but I'm handing out a college diploma to them as a result of their activity. And in many cases, they've been able to get that college diploma through the high school, through the state-funded program of dual enrollment. And we're also supporting Washington State students doing dual enrollment. So again, we've tried to connect the dots in terms of building the dreams and transforming lives of the high school students to the workforce needs, and hopefully by connecting those dots that we will create a brighter community.
Chairman Witt, Dr. Ernie Keller, Columbia Gorge Community College, third term. They're four-year terms, but I've spread that out over some 30 years, so it's not all one thing. And the only thing I have to say is that I've been pretty successful. I was on the committee that helped hire Frank. I haven't been able to say much since that time.
Thank you, Dr. Keller.
If maybe I could just have you two gentlemen hold tight here because you've probably provided the perfect segue into.
Well, I wanted to give Representative Esquivel where we are.
You teed it up for him, so.
Now I'm ready for the big question.
Before I turn it over to Representative Esquivel, I would just like to take a second to note that there have been several members of the United Food and Commercial Workers who have been present in the audience today, I think a half dozen of them, in support of workforce development. They come out of the retail industry. Folks say that, everybody has to eat food during a recession. It doesn't matter. The fact that they're here in support of workforce development from their industry, thank you very much. I certainly appreciate your support. With that, we had, again, our committee report that I had asked the members to review over the weekend, and much of what we have talked about, not only in the report, but some of the discussions that we have had individually, and Representative Esquivel has had here today, discusses the importance of education in workforce development. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ever since I've been in this building, we always, it seems like it's Groundhog Day when it comes to talking about this issue. Seems like we talk a lot about it, we just don't do a heck of a lot about it. I think it's time that we as legislators provide the leadership and to get local districts and community colleges as well as the private sector to the table and to allow them to craft out a plan for a seamless transition between high school and the working world itself. I think that should include not only our high schools and community colleges, but our business sector and our labor sector as well. It should be a partnership that we all can be involved in. I think what we need to do, and I will make this suggestion, that we have a interim committee between the people that I've just talked about and give them an opportunity in the next 2 years to craft out a plan and bring it to the legislature the next session that will work. Because right now, and you hit on it, some people in our high schools find out that, yeah, they do have a future. And, you know, if you have no purpose, it's very, very difficult to excel. And it grieved me so to find out that our school district has just knocked off its last wood shop. And that grieves me so. I think that if we give the people, local people, an opportunity to come back to us in 2 years with a plan for their specific region, and this includes the 17 community colleges that we have in the state of Oregon, and specifically earmark those to have a committee that is made up of what I have talked about, and of course there may be other people that we want involved in that, but let them craft a plan for the next session and come into us and say, okay, this is the idea we have, and this is how we can make it work. Obviously, you've made it work. So, obviously, they don't have to really reinvent the wheel, but it may not be specific for their region, and it may not work quite as well. I know in our particular region, we're very fortunate because we have the Table Rock campus at Rogue Community College that has all the facility, the infrastructure in place. We just don't have the students there from the high school, and I think that's something that we need to work on. So that would be my proposal, that we do work, and hopefully we can co-sponsor this, and I think we should look into that with the Education Committee, because I think we need to go hand in hand and be in lockstep on this issue, because the ones that are being shortchanged are students. So I do recommend that, sir.
Thank you, Representative Esquivel. And I think that integration is critically important, not only between our school folks and the workforce, but also, as Vice Chair Huffman has pointed out, our high schools and our community colleges. And so critically fundamental there may be some enabling things that we need to prepare in advance. And Representative Esquivel and Dembro, I was wondering if the two of you would be willing to take a look at that and see if there's some legislation that maybe this committee, in concert with the Education Committee, ought to be preparing now so that we can do that work that you discussed in the interim. Would the two of you be willing to take a look at that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. My good colleague from the land of the rogue, we've already been talking about it, and I think it's this is a very, very important concept, both bringing students, giving them community college training in their high schools, but also bringing them onto campuses, making good use of our facilities, and revolving it all around the workforce.
Very good. I'm going to ask Kevin if he will contact the Education Committee, and I will be part of that contact as well, and see if there is something jointly that we think we need to be teeing up for this session and in preparation, perhaps, for the interim. I appreciate your willingness, both of you, to do that. And Kevin, if there is anything that we need legislatively, we're in a tight time frame now?
Yes, as I understand it, the day to submit bill requests, both committees and individual legislators, is Monday of next week. So I believe, although I will confirm that for Thursday.
Is that like 10:30 today?
Like 10:20, but you know, give or take, there may be some flexibility. But they do need to be submitted to legislative council. But what I'll do, working with Representative Esquivel and also Representative Dembro, is communicate with you as far as no later than our next meeting on Thursday if there are any other hitches that come up. And I'll also speak with the Education Committee as far as if there are any other impediments to having perhaps a joint two joint committees sponsoring the legislation. I presume they're not, but I don't want to step on some kind of...
And Mr. Chair, I might just add, I'm the vice chair of the Education Committee, and we're having
great segue.
We have our standing leadership meeting on Tuesday afternoon. Perfect. So I'll bring it up
with you. If you would carry that request to them, I'd appreciate
today.
That.
Today. Yeah.
And Drs. Toda and Keller, if we could feel free, may we, to contact you?
Certainly.
Thank you so much. Do either of you gentlemen have anything further?
I just would have a small suggestion, Chair Witt, Representative Dembro, Representative Esquivel, about this conversation that you're having. And I'm directing more toward Representative Dembro here, who he and I have worked together before. There is some very, very good work that has been done in the Pathways Initiative, okay, Mimi Maduro, and as a statewide director. I would look at maybe the Pathways Initiative as a cross-cutting activity for community colleges, K-12, and workforce. A lot of the things that I was talking about in terms of what we've done at Columbia Gorge, we have actually stolen from the Pathways Initiative. And again, there's a lot of good things that might be sifted out of the Pathways activity. I know there's some initiatives going through right now about the Pathways program. I think that a lot of folks don't understand what it's about, that it really is about workforce training. And then finally, as you're having that conversation, I always like to remind myself anyway that the world is changing so quickly that we need to be watching for opportunities to leverage distance learning technologies as we do this. Distance learning technologies would allow colleges, for example, to share the imbalance that Representative Esquivel was talking about if there was a way to coordinate it through something like a Pathways infrastructure. So again, just some thoughts that I have been carrying around for a while, and I appreciate the opportunity to share it, Chairwoman.
We certainly appreciate your making yourselves available to this committee and answering our questions.
I'm always interested in coincidences. Many years ago, I had the same job as James Paulson. I found it to be a coincidence yesterday that I ended up on the radio when I was invited to come down and have a cup of coffee with our previous community college president. And then I find this a coincidence that I'm here talking today, or listening to Dr. Toda. And I want to leave you with just one number. In the gorge, we have 1,500 turbines and already installed. I've talked to some of our instructors, and they say we can put these turbines in as far as Ontario, so there's no real site in the end. And it takes one full-time turbine technician to keep six of those running year-round. So there's a lot of opportunity for job training, and it was somewhat of a coincidence that we got into this business, but because we had good, highly qualified personnel leading our community college organization, and I thank you for letting us talk to you today.
Thank you so much, and it's not only good-paying jobs, but it sounds like it's job security. Kevin, if you would please give us a brief summary of what we're going to be doing Thursday.
Yes, we're going to do that. Chairman Witt, members of the committee, we're going to have a couple more informational meetings that are set on Thursday. Marion Haynes, the Oregon Business Association, John Marshall of Associated Oregon Industries, and Michael Dewey of the National Federation of Independent Business will be giving business perspective concerning workforce development issues. We're also going to have Cam Prius visit with us again. She's actually bringing in a couple of other community college officers, Nan Pope of Portland Community College, as well as John Carnahan of Tillamook Bay. They also are going to be speaking about some workforce development issues as well. So, again, that's set for Thursday.
Questions, committee members? Don't forget session at 10:15. With that, we stand adjourned until Thursday.